Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, John Lewis Gaddis tells us about the extraordinary life and career of diplomat George F. Kennan. Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Children's books editor Pamela Paul and I have a conversation with legendary author Chris Van Allsburg. And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. George F. Kennan is probably the most celebrated diplomat and strategic thinker in American history. He's the subject of a major new biography, long in the waiting, by the great diplomatic historian John Gaddis. It's called George F. Kennan, An American Life. It's reviewed at considerable length on our cover by Henry Kissinger, a man who knows a great deal about strategy and diplomacy. I'm delighted that Professor Gaddis is joining us from his home in New Haven. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Sam.
All right. Now, Henry Kissinger says in his review, and, you know, you make pretty clear in the book, Americans today don't really understand or even know who George Kennan was. So tell us briefly why this man was a giant, perhaps the wisest of the wise men.
Well, I think he was a giant. We can come back to the issue of wisdom later on. But I think he was a giant because at a very critical moment in the history of the early Cold War, when it became apparent that the Soviet Union was not going to continue to be a glorious wartime ally, it seemed to many people that the only choices available were a third World War fought with the Soviet Union on the one hand, or appeasement on the other. And it was very difficult for people to think about any third alternative. It was Kennan who came up with the idea of a third way. And the third way was simply to hold the line, to fortify the Western position. That's what the Marshall Plan was all about. But simply be patient and confront the Soviet Union with continuing frustration of its own ambitions, and sooner or later its own internal contradictions, of which he was very much aware, would bring about a change in its character, whether that was a change in the regime or a change in the leadership or whatever, he left vague. But it really is uncanny because this is 1946 and 1947, and he's really coming very close to anticipating what Gorbachev would do four decades later. So it was an amazing prediction.
So, John, this is the celebrated word containment, yet the containment strategy, even in its own time, it was a cause of considerable controversy, for instance, with the greatest journalist and pundit of the era, Walter Lippmann.
Oh, yes. Well, part of this was Kennan's fault, because he was not always as clear as he should have been in his writing. Part of the problem was that he wrote so vividly that sometimes the actual drama of the prose obscured the meaning of it. And in the case of Walter Lippmann, he made a big mistake, too, because he simply confused what Truman had said in the Truman Doctrine speech, we're going to contain communism everywhere, with what he should have known George was recommending, because he talked to George regularly, which is that we contain communism selectively. We pick our battles. We pick the areas where we can be most effective. And, of course, that's what the Marshall Plan was all about.
John, and tell us a little bit about Kennan. He came from an unusual, actually quite distinguished, but not celebrated or wealthy family in the American Middle West. You know, we think of him as kind of a pillar of the establishment, but he was a Midwesterner.
That's correct, Sam. He was born in Milwaukee. The family were middle class. They were certainly not wealthy. When Kennan went to Princeton in the 1920s, early 1920s, he felt very left out of things because he did not have the money that the other boys had. The Foreign Service is his entree into the establishment, but he always felt that he was an outsider in the establishment. One great claim to fame that he had, which was indirect, was an ancestor, the first George Kennan, 1845 to 1924, who was the great explorer of Siberia. But sadly, the two branches of the family were not close, and young George met the old George only once. When he was a little boy. So it was a very distant legacy, which nonetheless had a great influence young George's decision to go into Russian studies.
And one of the revelations for me in the book was how gifted a linguist and kind of cultural traveler and tourist Cannon was, picking up languages. He had a feel for other cultures. Where did that come from?
Well, the languages, I think, probably in part came from Milwaukee, because he really grew up bilingual in English and German. Milwaukee was a German enough city at that point that would have been quite natural for him. And then at Princeton, he picked up some French. Certainly in high school, he would have picked up some Latin, as most people did in that period. But what he really loved was Russian. And it was when he entered the Foreign Service and joined the small group of young Foreign Service officers who were being trained for Russia that he actually learned Russian. He learned Russian in the Baltic states and in Berlin in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
In fact, he considered for many years he wanted to write a biography of Chekhov.
Absolutely. And his exposure to Russian culture was really exposure to pre-revolutionary Russian culture, because the people he learned Russian from and the people he was hanging out with in the Baltics and in Berlin were exiles from the revolution. So his culture is very much that of a pre-revolutionary Russian gentleman.
And yet, John, after Kennan left government service, which was really in the Eisenhower years in an official capacity, he did embark on a tremendously successful literary career. I hadn't realized just how successful it had been. The prizes he won, he was the president of the National Institute of Arts and Letters and American Academy. How does his writing and his own original history, his researched history, hold up today?
Well, it's an interesting story, Sam, because he got into it because he was asked to give some lectures at the University of Chicago in 1951. These became his first book, American Diplomacy, which is a very short and simple but influential book. But in the process of preparing the lectures, he made the mistake of showing the drafts to some historians at Princeton, among them Arthur Link, the biographer of Woodrow Wilson. And the historians trashed Kennan's lecture drafts. And he became very defensive about this because he was taking a position at the Institute for Advanced Study, and the expectation was that he would become a scholar. So he really overcompensated with the next books, which were two volumes on the very early history of Soviet-American relations from the time of the Bolshevik Revolution about through the end or through the middle of 1918. He took 1,000 pages to describe less than 1 year in Soviet and American relations.
Are those books read now?
Yes. Nobody has written a better one or a better two of those early of that early period. They're wonderful books, both for their scholarship, but also for their literary quality. And that was what was so astonishing. And that comes back to your point about Kennan as a great writer. Because this really first became clear, I think, to the public when he published those massive histories. It certainly is clear in his own writings, his private writings, from when he was very young.
John, Kennan lived an extraordinarily long life. I mean, here's a man who, when he entered the Foreign Service, actually caught a glimpse of President Calvin Coolidge, and he was alive after 9/11. You knew him personally. This was, in a sense, a kind of commissioned as opposed to authorized biography. Listeners should understand, no serious biographer wants to write an authorized biography. It means the subject gets to approve the manuscript. But this was a book that Kennan essentially chose you to write. So talk a little bit about your own relationship with this remarkable man.
Well, it's a remarkable story, Sam, because I really had met George only about 3 times at the time that we actually began talking about the biography. So we really did not know each other at all. But he had read something that I had written about him, which was the preliminary chapters of the book Strategies of Containment, which came out in 1982. And he liked the treatment. He thought I had been fair to him. And I started getting really quite astonishing fan letters from him. Saying, you have understood my views better than anyone else ever has, you know, so on and so forth. Several of these, which were quite amazing for a young, fairly obscure historian, you know, like myself at that time. So finally, I ventured to ask him if anybody was writing his biography with his cooperation. And he wrote back and said, oh, it had never occurred to him anybody would want to write his biography. But we talked about it and decided on the terms for doing it, which are as you described, which he would have no control over the contents of it. Indeed, would never read, but I would have full access to the papers. And then when I got into the papers, I started finding little notes going all the way back to the 1950s and the 1940s, clipped to documents that said, to the biographer, you should pay particular attention to this, that, and the other.
Thanks so much, John Gaddis.
Thank you, Sam.
That's John Lewis Gaddis, whose new book, George F. Kennan, An American Life, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So another plagiarism issue.
It is a recurring problem in the publishing industry, and this week it happened again. Little Brown and Company announced that it would pull a mystery novel from the shelves after it found out, only 5 days after the book was published, that it had been plagiarized from a number of other novels, including Robert Ludlum novels and James Bond books.
And who discovered this?
It was discovered, as these things usually are, by someone online who had noticed similarities between the books and started to post a bunch of passages that were not only sort of similar, but incredibly similar, and starting very early in the book, I think around page 13.
Whoops.
The book was written by a guy named Q.R. Markham, or that is his pen name anyway. His real name is Quentin Rowan, and he's a bookseller and investor in Spoonbill and Sugartown, which is a store in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Oh my gosh, so this is a local culprit. Has he said anything about this? Has he acknowledged or admitted or addressed this question?
He did not make any statement, at least that I'm aware of. When I talked to the people at the bookstore, they said that they did not expect him to come in that day. So he's been very quiet. This was his debut novel, and it's clear that there was really no mistaking what happened here. He had spoken in interviews and talked about how he was very influenced by James Bond novels, and when he was researching and writing his own, that played into his own style.
Julie, it seems as if this author, or putative author, did not plagiarize from the most obscure sources. James Bond. How does this happen?
Well, he chose from the best. I think in an ideal situation, editors at publishing houses are very specialized and have specialized areas of knowledge, and that is for a reason. And perhaps an editor who read this book, who read Q.R. Markham's book, and had also read a lot of the classics of the genre might have noticed the similarities. Obviously, it didn't happen in this case. Little Brown acted swiftly. They told bookstores to pull the novel from the shelves. The ebook edition was not on sale on BNN.com and Amazon quite immediately. And Little Brown, of course, has had experience in this area. Only 5 years ago, they published a book by a Harvard sophomore, a young adult novel, which was also plagiarized, and they had to pull that one from the shelves as well.
Now, that one, that was how Opal Mehta got her groove back, or
got kissed, got wild, and got a life.
Now, that was a very big deal. Was this mystery novel one that they had invested a fair amount in? Little Brown is an extraordinarily successful publisher. Was this a big title for them, as they say, or just another book they'd released?
It was not a big title, really. I know we're comparing two books at different times in the publishing industry in two different genres, but the Opal Mehta book had, been a print run of 100,000 copies, and the publisher had shipped something like 55,000 copies to stores. This was a much smaller book. The publisher said that they would print 6,500 copies of the book at the time that it was yanked from the shelves. It was ranked something like 49,000 on Amazon. So this was not the lead fiction title for Mulholland Books, which is part of Little Brown.
Could be a collector's item, though.
It could be. I ordered a copy.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Chris Van Allsburg is a legend in children's books and book publishing, the author of classics like Jumanji and The Polar Express, and we're delighted he's here to have a conversation, not really so much with me, as with our great children's books editor, Pamela Paul.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well, I'm happy to be here.
So this fall, you have a new book, The Chronicles of Harris Burdock, which is really a collection of writing by huge names in children's literature, everyone from Lois Lowry to Walter Dean Myers, and then some people who are not necessarily associated with children's
Correct.
Literature, like Stephen King and Cory Doctorow. How did this book come about? This was based on an earlier book that you did.
Yeah, some years ago, a book entitled The Mysteries of Harris Burdock appeared, and that book presented scant material for story making. The introduction that appears with that book, The Mysteries of Harris Burdock, describes an experience that I had many years ago with a retired book editor and publisher whose name was Peter Wenders. I met him at a book signing at a little library in Amherst, Massachusetts, and he waited along after I'd signed everyone's books and was eager to speak to me. And what he wanted to share with me was a collection of drawings which had been in his possession for some years, since the early 50s. So he persuaded me to come to his home and look at these drawings, and he described to me how they came to be in his possession. Very unusual circumstances. In the early 50s, a man appeared at his offices in Boston, and he brought with him 14 pictures. And he explained to Peter Wenders, the editor, that these 14 pictures were a small portion of what he'd been doing over many years. He'd done 14 pictures for 14 stories. That's a lot of work.
That's a lot.
So this is someone who toiled in isolation and solitude, and at some point in his life was courageous enough to finally share it, and he decided to share it with Peter Wenders. But evidently not courageous enough to bring the entire body of work. It may have simply been too heavy. These drawings are quite large in their original form. But he visited Wenders. Wenders loved what he saw and encouraged Burdock to return as soon as possible with the missing stories and the missing drawings that would accompany these 14.
And he never showed up.
He never showed up. I mean, it was clear to Wenders on this meeting in the early 50s that he was an unconventional and eccentric person. So Wenders was willing to accept the fact that maybe he had to rediscover his courage, and it would be a week later, maybe 10 days later, but he was convinced he would see Wenders again, or excuse me, Burdock again, but it never happened. So years and years passed by, and these 14 drawings, which Burdock left behind, which bore the title from the story from which they came, and a caption that associated that picture with the narrative— those were the only things that were marked on the drawings, and Wenders had had those in his possession for decades when he first approached me.
And now each of these pictures came with a title and one caption.
Yes.
And it's up to children or librarians or teachers or grown-ups to come up with their own stories. And now 25 years later, give or take a few years,
yes,
a number of writers have.
From the moment the book was published, I had this idea that these stories, or I shouldn't say stories, but these fragments that Burdock created and that Peter Wenders saved, and which Houghton Mifflin was brave enough to publish without fear of intellectual property legal disputes, they published these things, and I always imagined that they would be like the seeds that Johnny Appleseed sowed. That these little things would grow up into stories, and I was delighted to discover that that was exactly the effect that the book had had. Classroom teachers embraced it. Not long after it was published, I started getting a stream of stories from classroom teachers who weren't sending them to me for critiques. They just said, isn't this remarkable how these pictures and words can, you know, kids who'd never thought they could write a story, I hand out this picture, I give them these words, and they're off in the corner, you know, chewing on their pencil and scratching their head, and they actually become writers.
What drew you to the pictures themselves? How would you characterize them? I mean, they all seem to be very much capturing a very specific moment in time that could, though they're quite specific, could open up in a number of different ways.
Yes, and that's there's absolute proof of that in this collection from the Chronicles by these more experienced writers. Because when you look at the picture and you look at the caption, some writers felt that they were confronting something that indicated that the story was drawing to a close. And others placed this information that Burdick had left behind as the opening of the story. Some of the responses, they hew quite closely to what you might think of as the mood or atmosphere that Burdick had intended, but others don't, and they go off on kind of unusual tangents. And it's really a pleasure to, interesting to watch the imaginative forces in the minds of the individuals, how they respond to this.
So how did this book come about, The Chronicles of Harris Burdick? Was this your idea? Did someone, I mean, I know that Stephen King, of course, developed one of the stories on his own.
Yes, I learned some years ago when Stephen King requested the rights to reproduce an image from The Mysteries of Harris Burdick, the house on Maple Street, which depicts a suburban house headed for the Milky Way. I learned that he had written a story based on that. He was going to include it in an anthology, and he wanted to share with his readers what the inspiration was, because his family actually used The Mysteries of Harris Burdick. Tabitha, Stephen's wife, was also found the one of the Burdick images irresistible.
And she writes about it in the book.
She also was a contributor. So Stephen did this some years ago. That particular story was in print, and so my editor at Hope Mifflin, Margaret Ramos, said, you know, we've got this piece by Stephen, and why don't we go out and see what other experienced storytellers, whether they would be interested in accepting an invitation to take on a Burdick story.
Now, I know these aren't quite your babies, the pictures themselves, but did you have a favorite among the actual pictures that Harris Burdick left behind?
Well, the original jacket describes or depicts a group of people on a rail car that has a sail which assists its motion across this railroad track, which is going out on a jetty. And I found in some ways that was perhaps the most enigmatic. And for that reason, with consultation with Peter Wenders, we decided that that would make a stirring and provocative cover. But when we started out doing it and inviting people to choose a picture, obviously the ones who were on board first had a large selection. The last person in was not going to have a choice, and I felt badly about that. So I said, well, the second-to-last person who agrees to join our group of authors, I want them to at least have a choice of two. And I said that would leave one drawing, an orphan, one that was not stimulating to anyone else. I will take the orphan. I will take the drawing no one wanted. And so that's how I ended up with Oscar and Alphonse.
And that drawing is of?
That drawing depicts a young girl who is standing in a woodland setting, and she has her hand bent, and you can just barely make out in the image tiny little dark marks, which the title and caption actually identify. The caption is, she knew it was time to say goodbye. The caterpillars slowly spelled out goodbye. So this is a girl who, in my imagination, very quickly had a relationship with these creatures, and she had found a way to communicate with them. All of these pictures suggest something somewhat supernatural or out of the ordinary is part of the story. And I tried to write a story that suggested it may or may not be, just because I like mysteries.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris Van Allsburg and Pamela Paul.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Queen is dead. Long live the King. Jennifer Schussler has left us, although she's still at the New York Times. She just won't be doing her bestseller column anymore. But Her admirable successor and previous fill-in on occasion, Gregory Coles, is here to talk about bestseller news. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
Big shoes to fill, but that's not a comment on Jenny's feet. So what's new on the list this week?
Well, on the fiction side of things, it's pretty much the usual. We have a new number one. It's David Baldacci's new thriller, Zero Day. Danielle Steele and Richard Paul Evans also have new books on the list. So does Gregory Maguire, the guy who did the Wicked series. It's his last book set in his kind of alternative Oz. This book is called Out of Oz. And there's a new romantic book, The Wedding Quilt, by a woman named Jennifer Chiaverini, I think.
All right, Greg, what about nonfiction?
There's been a lot of turnover on the nonfiction list this week, Sam. Condoleezza Rice makes the list at number 5 with her memoir in defense of her time in office as Secretary of State called No Higher Honor. Chris Matthews also on the list with a profile of Jack Kennedy that's new at number 3. Nestled in between Chris Matthews and Condoleezza Rice is Joan Didion with her book Blue Nights. That's a memoir of her daughter, a remembrance of her daughter's death.
Greg, everyone will remember that with her previous memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, Joan Didion not only had an enormous international bestseller, but really introduced a new phrase or popularized a phrase in the language. And that book, of course, was about the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn. What's going on in this new book? Is this a different kind of story, different kind of memoir?
No, it's very much the same kind of memoir. Readers of Year of Magical Thinking will remember that in that book, when John Gregory Dunn died of a heart attack, their daughter, Quintana Rue Dunn, that's now Quintana Rue Dunn Michael, she got married, was in the hospital in a coma. She'd had septic shock. You know, it was this terrible story. She was in her late 30s. She lasted for about 20 months seriously ill before she died after John Gregory Dunn did. And so Joan Didion had these two big losses at once, and she grappled with her husband's death in Year of Magical Thinking. Now she's grappling with her daughter's death in Blue Nights.
It's interesting. Didion has created this new place for herself. She's always famous as the most detached and dispassionate of writers. What about in this memoir? She's talking about not only the death, but really the life of her daughter, and raises a lot of questions about how good a mother she was.
She questions herself what kind of mother she was in it. It's a very painful book and filled with observations and remembrances of her daughter. But her daughter still feels like a hard character to get to know through Joan Didion's eyes. She's always held at a little bit of a distance through it. But it's a very self-questioning book.
The Year of Magical Thinking kind of made her public again. Is there any public
side? It did. There was a play based on Year of Magical Thinking. Vanessa Redgrave played Joan Didion. I'm not sure what she's doing to promote Blue Nights. There have obviously been profiles and articles, and the death of her daughter was widely reported when it happened back in, I think, 2009. One thing that I found digging around, it's something that Didion doesn't mention in the book, but Quintana Roo, who was named after the Mexican state, went to Bennington College at the same time as Donna Tartt and Bret Easton Ellis, a couple of novelists who went on really to the big time. Jonathan Lethem was there at the same time. And while she was there, she became friends with Bret Easton Ellis. And,
also from California, like herself.
A California novelist, as Didion was, and a big acolyte of Joan Didion's. In fact, I found Ellis had posted to his Twitter account a remembrance of pinning Quintana down in her early days on campus with the campus drug dealer. The two of them were kind of grilling her about her mother and talking about literature until it dawned on her that the drug dealer thought she was actually Joan Rivers' daughter. She said, no, different Joan.
And I'm sure there was more than one drug dealer at Bennington here in those days. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.